Hi, I'm Rimchim Gaur. I'm a political consultant and a grassroots wanderer. I run two brainchilds. First is Sapiens Research and Analysis, and second is Gramya. And you are listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing.
Yeah. My name is Abhay Dandekar, and I share conversations with talented and interesting individuals linked to the global Indian and South Asian community. It's informal and informative, adding insights to our evolving cultural expressions, where each person can proudly say, trust me, I know what I'm doing. So periodically on Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing, we share a spotlight conversation and feature brief chats with an individual from the community about a special topic or a unique endeavor. On this spotlight episode, and in keeping with our ongoing mantra that conversation is the antidote to apathy, I wanted to amplify ways that give voice to those who aren't always heard, particularly at the grassroots level and for those in rural communities. So I was grateful to share a conversation with policy consultant and social entrepreneur, Rimchim Gaur. Rimchim is the founder of Gramya, a digital grassroots audio platform that facilitates two-way conversations on policy-related matters within rural communities. With Gramya, they've hosted over 50,000 conversations. These discussions have not only facilitated a deep knowledge transfer among villages and groups of women, but have also unveiled numerous inspiring stories of individuals who have achieved extraordinary feats despite limited resources. She also founded and leads Sapiens Research and Analysis, a political consultancy which works on empowering villages and creating a diverse network of grassroots surveyors to gather unbiased and candid local perspectives while building a trusted ecosystem of grassroots consultants and help drive the narrative on everything from social mobility and governing policy to political action. Currently, she has 7,000 plus grassroots consultants working with her across 5,500 local councils in India and South Asia, and she aspires to build the largest network of rural consultants across the world. Particularly with a lens on women, Rimchim believes in placing the power right in the hands of female nurturers of the country, affecting change for issues around women's health, digital and financial literacy, and female entrepreneurship. So as we started chatting, I wanted to know more about how she came to realize the allure and power of working with rural communities.
Yeah. So basically what happened is that I started working pretty early in my life. I was 19 years old and I was doing my graduation and I was not that much into studies, but I was already interning with, top leading newspapers and dailies. And at that point of time, I thought that I would want to look at international relations, you know, the glamours associated and a 19-year-old mind, you know, want to do things around it. But unfortunately, or in fact, if I now say fortunately, my editor ended up giving me rural as my beat.
Ah.
So now I started traveling across and I kind of covered like 120 villages across one state, the central province of India, which is Madhya Pradesh, over a period of 6 months. And after traveling to those areas, I kind of realized that this is where the real story lies. Mm. I mean, there will be so many people who would want to just take that jet off and do IR and would do beautifully, of course.
Yeah.
But how many people are really willing to go here to explore culture? And every village in itself is a cultural center that way, a hub of culture. And when I used to go to these places, people used to say that you are the first person who's come to us, who wants to speak to us. And this has never happened again. And maybe we don't expect anyone to come after you. And that's when I started realizing that this is where we need to go. And given we have 200,000 village councils in India, which roughly translate to 500,000, I would say, villages. Even if the entire workforce starts focusing on them, we still won't be able to complete or, you know, ensure a last mile reach.
Yeah.
And that's how the entire concept of hitting the rural areas, hitting the grassroots, understanding the economic, the sociopolitical, the cultural value of it, the entire, I would say, the expedition began.
You know, when those people asked you the question, you're the first person to come and I imagine that you weren't necessarily the first person to do this, but something clicked there for you in seeing that value, in seeing that, and in some ways, I imagine that it was a surprise, but it obviously compelled you to return and to say that this is where I belong. Has that, over the course now of your brief career, but has that sense of belonging and feeling mm-hmm. at home, has that mm-hmm. translated to all the different rural areas and villages that you continue to visit and work with?
Actually, yes. I kind of figured out one thing, that one rural area might be very different from the another.
Yeah.
And as I say, is untouched by the curse of urbanization in most of the right. cases. But still, the warmth and I would say how welcoming the people in rural areas are, that stays very consistent throughout. And yeah. That one thing, their curiosity, their, I would say, warmth to know you more, to tell you more, that too in a very, I would say, innocent and uncensored way. I think that stays very, very consistent. Of course, you have to put in a lot of effort to understand their culture, to kind of learn their language. But if they see that, if you are able to, you are putting, you know, walking a step for them, they are, of course, more than happy to walk 10 steps for you.
Has that perhaps made you yourself a little bit more innocent and a little bit more uncensored when you are sharing those stories, or when perhaps you're even now communicating with those who aren't so familiar with rural culture?
Oh, yes. I think it has to be like a two-way street.
Yeah. As you've now learned these lessons, mm-hmm. I imagine that one of the things that plays a huge role here is just deep empathy. And so, you know, how has empathy played a role not only in the work that you lead, mm-hmm. but also for those who wield levers of power?
I think if you're working in a public sector, or if you are someone who's dealing with public on a daily basis, I think empathy becomes the top most thing, the first ingredient that you need to have in you. Yeah. It could be anything. It could be, of course, as you said, the people who are there in power. You could be someone who is just, you know, a salesperson for that matter.
Yeah.
But any negotiation, any decision or any discussion, if it's led by empathy, I think you just get the leverage over there. Mm. Because while we might try to be very rational in our approach when we enter a discussion, or we are talking to someone professionally, or we are having a negotiation, I still think that human mind still works on animal instinct.
Yeah.
And as soon as the person right in front of you sees that there is a sense of empathy, a very, I would say, genuine concern with which you are speaking to that person, the animal instinct just shuts it off and the rationality takes over. And yeah. It's very easy to get people on board with you that way. Mm. It could be anything. If you are in a public sector, I think this is like, you know, topmost thing that has worked for me.
And I imagine that is incredibly powerful and such an important tool when you're actually either negotiating or trying to find and discover the stories that are so important in the rural areas, when others who work with you who are not necessarily from those rural areas, do you still find it that they often are sadly surprised by the amount of empathy that it takes to really, really make some kind of progress when it comes to communicating and helping to bridge some of those gaps?
Yes. In fact, one thing that surprised me is that people around, even if they haven't been or hit the ground and have just seen stories through me, through my communication, people around are equally empathetic about it. Of course, there are limitations, and of course, that's what I'm trying to fill in. That's what I'm trying to fill the gap through as right. well, that they get to hear it through me. But since there is no connect or direct medium that can, I mean, there are, but there are a very handful of medium that can get them real grassroots stories. Mm. People show a lot of concern, and so far it hasn't ever been the case where I haven't seen my level of empathy in people. So that's, of course, also a pleasant surprise for me, that people really want to go there. Of course, they are not able to. They go through me or through other people who are doing such work, but they really want to contribute. In fact, every day I get at least a couple of mails who say that we would want to contribute in whatever way we can. Mm. It could be like ideas, if you need help with something.
Yeah.
And that really keeps my faith alive. Like, we actually doing, we as a species are doing a pretty good job that way.
Let's hope so. Boy, yeah. I wanted to ask you one thing. You know, so one of the things that I found so incredibly interesting, and mainly because it's one of the philosophies of this particular podcast and this particular, show, is the idea that conversation is really the antidote to apathy. And in a way, this is something that certainly is embodied by Gramya itself and some of the storytelling that is involved there as well. What does Gramya in many ways offer as a solution for both the rural stakeholders and especially as a tool for empowerment when it comes to, you know, sometimes that very obvious economic or power or social, you know, discrepancy or gap that might be there when in dealing with external stakeholders in particular?
So I'll go a little bit, back and tell you how the idea kind of originated.
Yeah.
While trying to speak to people, so I ended up visiting 7,000 villages over a period of time. Mm. And while speaking to people, I figured out that the issue doesn't lie in people having a lack of information. In fact, I would say that people in rural landscape are more aware about what policies are, about what politics is looking like, because they are the ones who are actually getting the benefits, right?
Yeah.
So they are actually more aware. The problem is that they do not know how to communicate it to their electoral representative or to people who are in power.
Yeah.
And of course, like having Mahatma Gandhi as one of my idol, he always said that the real democracy is only complete when you are able to include your villages, when you are able to give a sense of independence to people who are living in the rural areas.
Mm.
So while kind of researching about it, while trying to understand that what could be done in order to ensure that it's easier for the elected representative as well as to the people, and we can kind of connect both of them. And yeah. While doing this, I figured out that the best way is communication. Yeah. And the best way we can empower even a person who can just read or speak, not even write, because there are many people who can't even write.
Yeah.
It's through communication. Mm. And that's how we ended up building Gramya. The idea was very clear that radio has the maximum reach in India.
Mm.
And no matter what level of internet we are at right now, we are still at 50%, and there are like only 30 to 35% active users of internet.
Yeah.
However, radio penetration or audio-enabled penetrations go more than 90% in India.
Yeah.
And have been growing on a very good rate. So, Prime Minister still runs a show called Man Ki Baat, and Man Ki Baat has seen amazing penetration.
Yeah.
So we started figuring out that there are takers who want to talk about policy, who want to listen about policy. Right. And we went through a lot of Man Ki Baat archives. We figured out that the only challenge with Man Ki Baat is that it's one way.
Yeah.
And taking inspiration from there, we decided to go bottom to top to the pyramid.
Yeah.
And we build a both-way conversation. So now what happens is the head of the council, village council, they moderate the conversation. They already know what are the policy topics we are going to talk about.
Yeah.
And they have, of course, the script with them. They discuss right. about it. And then the entire thing is transformed into, I would say, transcription, sentiment analysis, word clouding through AI, which then is handed over to ministries so that they can That's also great. Have a sense of what is policy execution looking like in every village. And they could see that what is like the discrepancy.
I'm particularly interested in what kind of feedback you've gotten and even what kind of feedback those policymakers have gotten with respect to empowering marginalized communities or populations, particularly women, particularly those who really traditionally have not been able to wield that power?
I think that's a very good question, because generally when we go to women, we were trying to figure out that what's one thing that we can start working on. And I think there are a lot of social impact leaders who are trying to figure the same thing out.
Yeah.
So So while working with women, a very broad sentiment that we got to know was that the entire concept of self-help groups has really worked out for them.
Yeah.
And they used to say that, so whenever I go to villages, sometimes we used to have the meetings in the community center. So they used to come there and tell me that the truth is that we were never allowed in the community center. It's right. just that right now, because of self-help groups, we are always in the group, so we enter. And yeah. then they got to the further bits of things that even today, we might not be able to go out individually and work. Mm. But if we are able to, for that matter, get cottage industries in our area and we are traveling in groups, it's socially very acceptable.
Yeah.
And that gave me an idea that irrespective of where you go, every woman has a sense of, in a way, achieving financial independence in some way or the other. It's not an urban area. It's not an urban idea. It's not a semi-urban idea.
Yeah.
Even areas which are like heavily tribal, women want it.
Yeah.
And though they want to stay in the groups, but they really want to do it. And that's how we also started getting a lot of cottage industries funded by yeah. private investors, by government. We gave ideas to government on how we can set private industries for what. So that we can start procuring things about it. And I think we did a very good job with Orissa and Millets over there. So that one thing really struck a chord with me that, yeah.
And you know, you mentioned this, and I'm thinking of, you know, the contrast of people on like Shark Tank who make a pitch to, you know, a group of investors. And mm-hmm. whether it's a group of investors, whether it's a group of policymakers, and maybe there's a difference between making a pitch and also staking what is rightfully yours and really sort of defining yourself and proclaiming your identity in this way. When people hear those stories, whether they're policymakers mm-hmm. or investors, what's usually their initial reaction? Is there some skepticism that you first have to make your way beyond? You know, I'm sure that there must be at least a balance of people who are skeptic and also people who are more than willing and welcome to embrace and look at new ideas, new markets, new voters, perhaps in their constituents.
When we started, of course, there was more of skepticism, and I still see more of skepticism, but most of the times it's a mix of both.
Yeah.
That when I start off, I see that people like, oh, this sounds like, you know, something new. What can we do more about it? And as soon as you get into detail, the skepticism clicks in.
Yeah.
So then you have to tell them that what's the market looking like, or it depends upon who the stakeholder is and what you're able to offer the stakeholder in that. For example, if we are talking to a politician, then of course we can tell them that this is what, you know, the voter demography is looking like.
Right.
And maybe if this is what you do, you'll be able to consolidate some voters for yourself. And here you're talking about 50% of the people when you say women.
Yeah.
So it's not like, you know, a small chunk that you're catering to. And good thing is that there has been a lot of focus. We just completed a section, I would say a leg of 5 elections right now.
Yeah.
And like 2 days back, and the entire focus was on female voters. So I think people have now started getting it because of social media, because of so many conversations happening around it.
You know, you mentioned this, and I'm struck by the fact that in an era where there's so much digital connectivity and mobiles are in the hands of nearly everyone, what more actually has to be done to bridge that communication gap between those, you know, external stakeholders and either women or rural community members?
I think the first thing, though, as you said, that mobiles exactly are with everyone. That is not very true for rural areas.
Sure.
Reason being that even though governments have given mobile to women that way, so that at least there's some access. But what happens is that as soon as they have the mobile, they give it to their kids. Or they give it to their husbands.
Right.
So it never stays with them. And that becomes the number one problem. So, in fact, when we were doing Gramya in Madhya Pradesh, for that matter, we had to create a helpline so that even women who have like the feature phone, going back to like what we used to use like in 2000s, they can still call us on a number and tell us that what do they have to say about a particular topic. So the very first thing that we need to really bridge gap is to make women understand the utility of phones. Because they're it still remains a very, I would say, a sound medium for entertainment, even for males for that matter, but they still haven't gotten used to it. Like you and I would do a podcast, or maybe we would, you know, do a Coursera, or maybe do something creative around it, but still not the thing. They are still like on Facebook and they are connected to each other. And I think that's one thing that people need to hack. How to get them on board, and at the same time, how to get them to listen. Of course, there is initial hesitancy because why should we? And I totally get it that even knowledge becomes privilege after a certain point. Like when you don't have to think about your day-to-day firefighting, it's only then you start thinking about, okay, maybe I can brainstorm new ideas. I can sit, do something new. But when you're busy with your day-to-day firefighting, I think you have like a very set template of your routine.
Has this, by the way, sharpened your sword, if you will, as a strategist and as someone who's developing analysis and research for stakeholders?
Honestly, it has. I still remember that, you know, digital, I think UPI and digital payments that has been a rage back in India. People were trying to figure out how to ensure financial inclusion, how to get more women use digital methods of payments. And the top one thing that we came out after talking to like 85,000 women was that women were very clear that they don't want to put their money in accounts just because they want to keep the money out of the eyes of the man of the house.
Yeah. And in many ways, I can imagine that itself is a huge barrier because of, you know, perhaps fear or family dynamics, social dynamics that are very much entrenched in these villages or in these rural situations.
Right. I mean, that insecurity is very much justified. It comes from a place of certain experience, certain events they've been through, as someone in their family has been through. So, and this is a very basic, I think, initial block that you need to resolve before you get into the entire digital literacy, I would say, realm for them. So I think those are the things that we forget about and which also limit our, I would say, success when we try to do something, which is like the impact. Like, I understand the impact, but are you able to communicate the impact to them? Do they think that the impact is big enough for them? Yes, I think that has really helped us, I would say, educate people who are working upon things.
And develop relationships, which is so important. I wonder, you know, through even all of the successes that you've had and with building relationships and creating this kind of basically upending the pyramid and, you know, making sure that there's a bidirectional voice to this, you know, one element which is such a challenge in any ecosystem, but particularly in a rural ecosystem, as you mentioned, that each small microcosm is so different, you know, perhaps even several kilometers from each other in our rural villages in India particularly. So I imagine that a challenge in doing this work is building trust, you know, especially among those who've been marginalized, again, with so much nuance and cultural context at this level. How do you navigate that when these relationships sometimes are very fragile? And for you, what is it actually taught you about, in some ways, the longitudinal sustainability of this kind of role that you've developed and the work that you're doing?
So, as you said, I think that's one thing that I still face, despite people knowing about Gramya. Reason being, the rural landscape or the people you meet, they've been cheated so many times, so often, when it comes to monetary scams, or stuff like that, that they become very insecure and they have a lot of trouble trusting you. Yeah. In fact, I still remember going to this one village where I literally was so enraged because LPG, like gas cylinders, are supposed to be given for free. They are supposed to be provided for free under Ujjwala scheme, one of the central schemes. And some person came, took 2,000 rupees from a family who doesn't even have a home to live in. They live like on roadside and the kitchen is also set under the skies. Mm. And then they told me that we paid 2,000 rupees for this. And I was so angry. I was angry. Of course, I was a little mad at them as well.
Yeah.
That you should ask questions. You should ask for credibility. Why not asking that? So events like these over a period of time, of course, creates a lot of insecurity and why should we trust you kind of an attitude. But again, I think that also stays true for a lot of us. Like, it takes time to build trust and it takes time for them to kind of start understanding the value of it over a period of time. So we try to figure out few people who would show trust, even if others won't. And we try to engage more with them till the time the others also come out and they are like, okay, I think now we trust what you are doing. So yeah.
You've been doing this great work with Gramya and of course the work that you're doing with Sapiens research and analysis as a political consultant, but also in many ways that the roles you play here, you know, you're part-time psychologist and social worker and counselor, and in a way also someone who is an organizer and playing a role, in fact, as a consultant as well. Mm-hmm. To someone who's entering any of these spaces for the first time, what advice would you give them, particularly if they are starting to do work that's similar like this for the very first time? What kind of advice or what words of wisdom would you have for someone who's entering this space as a new person?
I think one thing that really worked out for me, and I think I would also advise people should do, is try to look at the studies that have already happened. Try to look a lot of those studies in, I would say, the light of a certain geography first, and try to see what patterns are you able to build out of it.
Yeah.
I mean, there would be one, you would agree, there's not like one unidirectional way of looking at a research.
Yeah.
You could find like hundreds of angles. And then just find one angle that you think interests you, you want to delve further in. And do not digress from that for that till the time you haven't figured that out. I've seen people who try to focus on overall health of a village for that matter.
Yeah.
But that doesn't work. Even if you're able to do one thing, like, for example, financial inclusion, as I said it. And if you're able to get it correct as the first thing you do when you enter the space, you're able to create some sort of credibility for yourself that, okay, there was one problem this person has decently succeeded in solving. So sticking to one geography or one problem statement at a time and trying to resolve it, even if you have to, like, you know, spare 2 hours extra each day and just do it all by yourself, because that's most of how most of the people started. They started doing it all by themselves, you know, during burning the midnight oil.
Yeah.
And then just trying to create a case study out of it will really open a lot of doors for you in the entire domain that way. So yeah, stick to one problem, maybe burn the midnight oil, even if others are not supporting you at that point of time, and create a case study. I think that's the way to go about it.
Well, small wins and lots of effort and building trust and making great strides, especially with excellent storytelling and bridging communication gaps. Lidim Jim, thank you so much for sharing a little bit of your journey and your work with us. Congratulations on the success, and we wish you nothing but the best.
Thanks a lot. And you're doing an amazing job, by the way. I follow all the podcasts and I really look forward to hearing more of such stories. I think that's, again, a very interesting way of storytelling. So, yeah.
Thanks again, Lidim Jim. And thank you for listening and watching wherever that might be. And please don't forget to offer a kind rating or review for Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing, and pass it along to your friends and family. It's pretty simple. We're all connected and we're all human. Let's just try and remember that every day. Till next time, I'm Abhay Dandekar.